Diana. "What is the matter, my dear?" asked the gentleman whose name the lady's agitation revealed. "Tell me, what is the matter? Oh, Lucien, can I confide in you? Of course, you know you can do so. But what can be the matter? Your note of this morning has completely bewildered me. This precipitation, this disordered meeting. Come, ease me of my anxiety, or else frighten me at once. Lucien, a great event has happened," said the lady, glancing inquiringly at Lucien. "Monsieur Danglars left last night." "Left? Monsieur Danglars left? Where is he gone to?" "I do not know." "What do you mean? Is he gone intending not to return?" "Undoubtedly. At 10 o'clock at night, his horses took him to the barrier of Charenton. There, a post-chaise was waiting for him. He entered it with his valet de chambre, saying that he was going to Fontainebleau." "Then what did you mean?" "Stay. He left a letter for me." "A letter?" "Yes. Read it." And the Baroness took from her pocket a letter which she gave to Debray. Debray paused a moment before reading, as if trying to guess its contents, or perhaps while making up his mind how to act, whatever it might contain. No doubt his ideas were arranged in a few minutes, for he began reading the letter which caused so much uneasiness in the heart of the Baroness, and which ran as follows. "Madame and most faithful wife." Debray mechanically stopped and looked at the Baroness, whose face became covered with blushes. "Read," she said. Debray continued. "When you receive this, you will no longer have a husband. Oh, you need not be alarmed. You will only have lost him as you have lost your daughter. I mean that I shall be travelling on one of the 30 or 40 roads leading out of France. I owe you some explanations for my conduct, and as you are a woman that can perfectly understand me, I will give them. Listen, then. I this morning received 5 millions, which I paid away. Almost directly afterwards, another demand for the same sum was presented to me. I postponed this creditor till tomorrow, and I intend leaving today to escape that tomorrow, which would be rather too unpleasant for me to endure. You understand this, do you not, my most precious wife? I say you understand this because you are as conversant with my affairs as I am. Indeed, I think you understand them better, since I am ignorant of what has become of a considerable portion of my fortune, once very tolerable, while I am sure, madame, that you are perfectly acquainted with it. For women have infallible instincts. They can even explain the marvellous by an algebraic calculation they have invented. But I, who only understand my own figures, know nothing more than that one day these figures deceived me. Have you admired the rapidity of my fall? Have you been slightly dazzled at the sudden fusion of my ingots? I confess, I have seen nothing but the fire. Let us hope you have found some gold amongst the ashes. With this consoling idea, I leave you, madame, and most prudent wife, without any conscientious reproach for abandoning you. You have friends left, and the ashes I have already mentioned, and above all, the liberty I hasten to restore to you. And here, madame, I must add another word of explanation. So long as I hoped you were working for the good of our house and for the fortune of our daughter, I philosophically closed my eyes. But as you have transformed that house into a vast ruin, I will not be the foundation of another man's fortune. You were rich when I married you, but little respected. Excuse me for speaking so very candidly, but as this is intended only for ourselves, I do not see why I should weigh my words. I have augmented our fortune, and it has continued to increase during the last 15 years, till extraordinary and unexpected catastrophes have suddenly overturned it, without any fault of mine, I can honestly declare. You, madame, have only sought to increase your own, and I am convinced you have succeeded. I leave you, therefore, as I took you, rich, but little respected. Adieu. I also intend from this time to work on my own account. Accept my acknowledgments for the example you have set me, and which I intend following. Your very devoted husband, Baron Danglars.
The Baroness had watched Debray while reading this long and painful letter, and saw him, notwithstanding his self-control, change colour once or twice. When he had ended the perusal, he folded the letter and resumed his pensive attitude.
"Well?" asked Madame Danglars, with an anxiety easy to be understood. "Well, madame," unhesitatingly repeated Debray, "with what ideas does that letter inspire you?" "Oh, it is simple enough, madame. It inspires me with the idea that Monsieur Danglars has left suspiciously." "Certainly. But is this all you have to say to me?" "I do not understand you," said Debray with freezing coldness. "He is gone. Gone, never to return. Oh, madame, do not think that. I tell you, he will never return. I know his character. He is inflexible in any resolutions formed for his own interests. If he could have made any use of me, he would have taken me with him. He leaves me in Paris, as our separation will conduce to his benefit. Therefore, he has gone, and I am free for ever," added Madame Danglars in the same supplicating tone.
Debray, instead of answering, allowed her to remain in an attitude of nervous inquiry.
"Well," she said at length, "do you not answer me? I have but one question to ask you. What do you intend to do?"
"I was going to ask you," replied the Baroness with a beating heart.
"Ah, then you wish to ask advice of me?"
"Yes, I do wish to ask your advice," said Madame Danglars with anxious expectation.
"Then, if you wish to take my advice," said the young man coldly, "I would recommend you to travel."
"To travel?" she murmured.
"Certainly. As Monsieur Danglars says, you are rich and perfectly free. In my opinion, a withdrawal from Paris is absolutely necessary after the double catastrophe of Mademoiselle Danglars' broken contract and Monsieur Danglars' disappearance. The world will think you abandoned and poor, for the wife of a bankrupt would never be forgiven were she to keep up the appearance of opulence. You have only to remain in Paris for about a fortnight, telling the world you are abandoned and relating the details of this desertion to your best friends, who will soon spread the report. Then you can quit your house, leaving your jewels and giving up your jointure, and everyone's mouth will be filled with praises of your disinterestedness. They will know you are deserted, and think you also poor. For I alone know your real financial position, and am quite ready to give up my accounts as an honest partner."
The dread with which the Baroness, pale and motionless, listened to this was equalled by the calm indifference with which Debray had spoken.
"Deserted?"
she repeated. "Ah, yes, I am indeed deserted. You are right, sir, and no one can doubt my position." These were the only words uttered by the proud and violent woman.
"But then you are rich, very rich indeed," continued Debray, taking out some papers from his pocket-book, which he spread upon the table.
Madame Danglars saw them not. She was fully engaged in stilling the beatings of her heart and restraining the tears which were ready to gush forth. At length a sense of dignity prevailed, and if she did not entirely master her agitation, she at least succeeded in preventing the fall of a single tear.
"Madame," said Debray, "it is nearly 6 months since we have been associated. You furnished a principal of 100,000 francs. Our partnership began in the month of April. In May we commenced operations, and in the course of the month gained 450,000 francs. In June the profit amounted to 900,000. In July we added 1,700,000 francs. It was, you know, the month of the Spanish bonds. In August we lost 300,000 francs at the beginning of the month, but on the 13th we made up for it, and we now find that our accounts, reckoning from the first day of partnership up to yesterday when I closed them, showed a capital of 2,400,000 francs, that is, 1,200,000 for each of us.
Now, madame," said Debray, delivering up his accounts in the methodical manner of a stockbroker,
"there are still 80,000 francs, the interest of this money, in my hands."
"But," said the Baroness, "I thought you never put the money out to interest."
"Excuse me, madame," said Debray coldly. "I had your permission to do so, and I have made use of it. There are, then, 40,000 francs for your share, besides the 100,000 you furnished me to begin with, making in all 1,340,000 francs for your portion. Now, madame, I took the precaution of drawing out your money the day before yesterday. It is not long ago, you see, and I might be suspected of continually expecting to be called on to deliver up my accounts. There is your money, half in banknotes, the other half in checks, payable to the bearer. I say there, for as I did not consider my house safe enough, nor lawyers sufficiently discreet, and as landed property carries evidence with it, and moreover, since you have no right to possess anything independent of your husband, I have kept the sum, now your whole fortune, in a chest concealed under that closet, and for greater security I myself fastened it in.
Now, madame," continued Debray, first opening the closet, then the chest, "now, madame, here are 800 notes of 1,000 francs each, resembling, as you see, a large book bound in iron. To this I add a dividend of 25,000 francs. Then, for the odd cash, making, I think, about 110,000 francs, here is a check upon my banker, who, not being Monsieur Danglars, will pay you the amount, you may rest assured." Madame Danglars mechanically took the check, the dividend, and the heap of banknotes. This enormous fortune made no great appearance on the table. Madame Danglars, with tearless eyes, but with her breast heaving with concealed emotion, placed the banknotes in her bag, put the dividend and check into her pocket-book, and then, standing pale and mute, awaited one kind word of consolation. But she waited in vain.
"Now, madame," said Debray, "you have a splendid fortune, an income of about 60,000 livres a year, which is enormous for a woman who cannot keep an establishment here for a year at least. You will be able to indulge all your fancies. Besides, should you find your income insufficient, you can, for the sake of the past, madame, make use of mine. And I am ready to offer you all I possess.
on loan.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, replied the Baroness. You forget that what you have just paid me is much more than a poor woman requires, who intends for some time at least to retire from the world.
Debray was for a moment surprised, but immediately recovering himself, he bowed with an air which seemed to convey,
"As you please, madame."
Madame Danglars had until then, perhaps, hoped for something, but when she saw the careless bow of Debray and the glance by which it was accompanied, together with his significant silence, she raised her head and, without passion or violence or even hesitation, ran downstairs, disdaining to address a last farewell to one who could thus part from her.
"Bah," said Debray when she had left, "these are fine projects. She will remain at home, read novels, and speculate at cards, since she can no longer do so on the bourse."
Then, taking up his account book, he cancelled with the greatest care all the amounts he had just paid away.
"I have 1,060,000 francs remaining," he said. "What a pity Mademoiselle de Villefort is dead. She suited me in every respect, and I would have married her."
And he calmly waited till the 20 minutes had elapsed after Madame Danglars' departure before he left the house. During this time, he occupied himself in making figures with his watch by his side. Asmodeus, that diabolical personage who would have been created by every fertile imagination if Lesage had not acquired the priority in his chef d'oeuvre, would have enjoyed a singular spectacle if he had lifted up the roof of the little house in the Rue Saint-Germain-des-Prés while Debray was casting up his figures. Above the room in which Debray had been dividing 2.5 millions with Madame Danglars was another, inhabited by persons who have played too prominent a part in the incidents we have related for their appearance not to create some interest. Mercedes and Albert were in that room. Mercedes was much changed within the last few days. Her eye no longer sparkled, her lips no longer smiled, and there was now a hesitation in uttering the words which formerly fell so fluently from her ready wit. It was not poverty which had broken her spirit. It was not a want of courage which rendered her poverty burdensome. Mercedes appeared like a queen fallen from her palace to a hovel, and who, reduced to strict necessity, could neither become reconciled to the earthen vessels she was herself forced to place upon the table, nor to the humble pallet which succeeded her bed. The beautiful Catalane and noble countess had lost both her proud glance and charming smile, because she saw nothing but misery around her. The walls were hung with one of those grey papers which economical landlords choose as not likely to show the dirt. The floor was uncarpeted. The furniture attracted the attention to the poor attempt at luxury. Indeed, everything offended the eyes accustomed to refinement and elegance. Madame Morcerf had lived there since leaving her house. The continual silence of the spot oppressed her. Still, seeing that Albert continually watched her countenance to judge the state of her feelings, she constrained herself to assume a monotonous smile of the lips alone, which contrasted sadly with the sweet and beaming expression that usually shone from her eyes. Albert, too, was ill at ease. The remains of former luxury prevented him from getting accustomed to his actual position. If he wished to go out without gloves, his hands appeared too white. If he wished to walk through the town, his boots seemed too highly polished. Yet these two noble and intelligent creatures, united by the indissoluble ties of maternal and filial love, had succeeded in tacitly understanding one another and economizing their stores, and Albert had been able to tell his mother without extorting a change of countenance, "Mother, we have no more money." Mercedes had never known misery. She had often, in her youth, spoken of poverty, but between want and necessity, though synonymous words, there is a wide difference. Amongst the Catalans, Mercedes wished for 1,000 things, but still she never really wanted any. So long as the nets were good, they caught fish, and so long as they sold their fish, they were able to buy thread for new nets. And then, shut out from friendship, having but one affection, which could not be mixed up with her ordinary pursuits, she thought of herself, of no one but herself. Upon the little she earned, she lived as well as she could. Now there were two to be supported, and nothing to live upon. Winter approached. Mercedes had no fire in that cold and naked room, she who was accustomed to stoves which heated the house from the hall to the boudoir. She had not even one little flower, she whose apartment had been a conservatory of costly exotics. But she had her son. Hitherto, the excitement of fulfilling a duty had sustained them. Excitement, like enthusiasm, sometimes renders us unconscious to the things of earth. But the excitement had calmed down, and they felt themselves obliged to descend from dreams to reality. After having exhausted the ideal, they found they must talk of the actual.
"Mother," exclaimed Albert, just as Madame Danglars was descending the stairs, "let us reckon our riches, if you please. I want a capital to build my plans upon." "Capital? Nothing," replied Mercedes with a mournful smile.
"No, mother, capital, 3,000 francs, and I have an idea of our leading a delightful life upon this 3,000 francs.
"Child," sighed Mercedes.
"Alas, dear mother," said the young man, "I have unhappily spent too much of your money not to know the value of it. These 3,000 francs are enormous, and I intend building upon this foundation a miraculous certainty for the future."
"You say this, my dear boy, but do you think we ought to accept these 3,000 francs?" said Mercedes, colouring.
"I think so," answered Albert in a firm tone. "We will accept them the more readily, since we have them not here. You know they are buried in the garden of the little house in the Allée des Meilleurs at Marseilles. With 200 francs we can reach Marseilles."
"With 200 francs? Think well, Albert."
"Oh, as for that, I have made inquiries respecting the diligences and steamboats, and my calculations are made. You will take your place in the coupé to Chalons. You see, mother, I treat you handsomely for 35 francs.
Albert then took a pen and wrote, "Coupé, 35 francs. From Chalons to Lyon, you will go on by the steamboat, 6 francs. From Lyon to Avignon, still by steamboat, 16 francs. From Avignon to Marseille, 7 francs. Expenses on the road, about 50 francs. Total, 114 francs. Let us put down 120, added Albert, smiling. "You see, I am generous, am I not, mother?"
"But you, my poor child,
I, do you not see, I reserve 80 francs for myself. A young man does not require luxuries. Besides, I know what travelling is.
With a post-chaise and valet de chambre.
Anyway, mother."
"Well, be it so. But these 200 francs,
here they are, and 200 more besides. See, I have sold my watch for 100 francs, and the guard and seals for 300. How fortunate the ornaments were worth more than the watch.
Still the same story of superfluities. Now I think we are rich, since, instead of the 114 francs we require for the journey, we find ourselves in possession of 250. But we owe something in this house. 30 francs, but I pay that out of my 150 francs, that is understood. And as I require only 80 francs for my journey, you see, I am overwhelmed with luxury. But that is not all. What do you say to this, mother?"
And Albert took out of a little pocketbook with golden clasps a remnant of his old fancies, or perhaps a tender souvenir from one of those mysterious and veiled ladies who used to knock at his little door. Albert took out of this pocketbook a note of 1,000 francs.
"What is this?" asked Mercedes.
1,000 francs.
"But whence have you obtained them?
Listen to me, mother, and do not yield too much to agitation." And Albert, rising, kissed his mother on both cheeks, then stood looking at her.
"Dear child," said Mercedes, endeavouring in vain to restrain a tear which glistened in the corner of her eye, Indeed, you only wanted misfortune to change my love for you to admiration. I am not unhappy while I possess my son.
Ah, just so, said Albert. Here begins the trial.
Do you know the decision we have come to, mother?
Have we come to any?
Yes. It is decided that you are to live at Marseille, and that I am to leave for Africa, where I will earn for myself the right to use the name I now bear, instead of the one I have thrown aside.
Mercedes sighed.
Well, mother, I yesterday engaged myself in the Spahi, added the young man, lowering his eyes with a certain feeling of shame, for even he was unconscious of the sublimity of his self-abasement. I thought my body was my own, and that I might sell it. I yesterday took the place of another. I sold myself for more than I thought I was worth, he added, attempting to smile. I fetched 2,000 francs.
Then these 1,000 francs, said Mercedes, shuddering, are the half of the sum, mother. The other will be paid in a year.
Mercedes raised her eyes to heaven with an expression it would be impossible to describe, and tears which had hitherto been restrained now yielded to her emotion and ran down her cheeks.
The price of his blood, she murmured.
Yes, if I am killed, said Albert, laughing, but I assure you, mother, I have a strong intention of defending my person, and I never felt half so strong an inclination to live as at present.
Merciful heavens!
Besides, mother, why should you make up your mind that I am to be killed? Has Lomarissiere, that Ney of the South, been killed? Has Changarnier been killed? Has Bedeau been killed? Has Morel, whom we know, been killed? Think of your joy, mother, when you see me return with an embroidered uniform. I declare, I expect to look magnificent in it, and chose that regiment only from vanity.
Mercedes sighed while endeavouring to smile. The devoted mother felt she ought not to allow the whole weight of the sacrifice to fall upon her son.
"Well, now you understand, mother," continued Albert. "Here are more than 4,000 francs settled on you. Upon these you can live at least 2 years."
"Do you think so?" said Mercedes.
These words were uttered in so mournful a tone that their real meaning did not escape Albert. He felt his heart beat, and, taking his mother's hand within his own, he said tenderly,
"Yes, you will live."
"I shall live."
"Then you will not leave me, Albert."
"Mother, I must go," said Albert, in a firm, calm voice. "You love me too well to wish me to remain useless and idle with you. Besides, I have signed.
You will obey your own wish and the will of heaven.
Not my own wish, mother, but reason, necessity. Are we not two despairing creatures? What is life to you?
Nothing.
What is life to me? Very little without you, mother, for believe me, but for you, I should have ceased to live on the day I doubted my father and renounced his name.
Well, I will live, if you promise me still to hope,
and if you grant me the care for your future prospects, you will redouble my strength.
Then I will go to the governor of Algeria. He has a royal heart and is essentially a soldier. I will tell him my gloomy story. I will beg him turn his eyes now and then towards me, and if he keep his word and interest himself for me, in 6 months I shall be an officer or dead. If I am an officer, your fortune is certain, for I shall have money enough for both, and moreover, a name we shall both be proud of, since it will be our own. If I am killed, well then, mother, you can also die, and there will be an end of our misfortunes.
It is well, replied Mercedes with her eloquent glance. You are right, my love. Let us prove to those who are watching our actions that we are worthy of compassion.
But let us not yield to gloomy apprehensions, said the young man. I assure you we are, or rather we shall be, very happy.
You are a woman at once full of spirit and resignation. I have become simple in my tastes, and am without passion, I hope. Once in service I shall be rich. Once in Monsieur Dante's house you will be at rest. Let us strive, I beseech you, let us strive to be cheerful.
Yes, let us strive, for you ought to live and to be happy, Albert,
"And so our division is made, Mother," said the young man, affecting ease of mind. "We can now part. Come, I shall engage your passage.
And you, my dear boy, I shall stay here for a few days longer. We must accustom ourselves to parting.
I want recommendations and some information relative to Africa. I will join you again at Marseille."
"Well, be it so. Let us part," said Mercedes, folding round her shoulders the only shawl she had taken away, and which, accidentally, happened to be a valuable black cashmere.
Albert gathered up his papers hastily, rang the bell to pay the 30 francs he owed to the landlord, and, offering his arm to his mother, they descended the stairs. Someone was walking down before them, and this person, hearing the rustling of a silk dress, turned round.
"Debray," muttered Albert. "You, Morcerf," replied the secretary, resting on the stairs. Curiosity had vanquished the desire of preserving his incognito, and he was recognized. It was, indeed, strange in this unknown spot to find the young man whose misfortunes had made so much noise in Paris.
"Morcerf," repeated Debray.
Then, noticing in the dim light the still youthful and veiled figure of Madame de Morcerf,
"Pardon me," he added with a smile. "I leave you, Albert."
Albert understood his thoughts. "Mother," he said, turning towards Mercedes, "this is Monsieur Debray, secretary of the Minister for the Interior, once a friend of mine."
"How, once?" stammered Debray. "What do you mean?"
"I say so, Monsieur Debray, because I have no friends now, and I ought not to have any. I thank you for having recognized me, sir." Debray stepped forward and cordially pressed the hand of his interlocutor.
"Believe me, my dear Albert," he said, with all the emotion he was capable of feeling, "believe me, I feel deeply for your misfortunes, and if in any way I can serve you, I am yours."
"Thank you, sir," said Albert, smiling. "In the midst of our misfortunes, we are still rich enough not to require assistance from anyone. We are leaving Paris, and when our journey is paid, we shall have 5,000 francs left." The blood mounted to the temples of Debray, who held a million in his pocketbook, and, unimaginative as he was, he could not help reflecting that the same house had contained two women, one of whom, justly dishonored, had left it poor with 1,500,000 francs under her cloak, while the other, unjustly stricken but sublime in her misfortune, was yet rich with a few deniers. This parallel disturbed his usual politeness. The philosophy he witnessed appalled him. He muttered a few words of general civility and ran downstairs. The next day, about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, Madame de Morcerf, after having affectionately embraced her son, entered the coupe of the diligence which closed upon her. A man was hidden in Lafitte's banking house behind one of the little arched windows which are placed above each desk. He saw Mercedes enter the diligence, and he also saw Albert withdraw. Then he passed his hand across his forehead, which was clouded with doubt.
"Alas," he exclaimed, "how can I restore the happiness I have taken away from these poor, innocent creatures? God help me."
108. The Lion's Den. One division of La Force, in which the most dangerous and desperate prisoners are confined, is called the Court of Saint Bernard. The prisoners, in their expressive language, have named it the Lion's Den, probably because the captives possess teeth which frequently gnaw the bars, and sometimes the keepers also. It is a prison within a prison. The walls are double the thickness of the rest. The courtyard of this quarter is enclosed by enormous walls, over which the sun glances obliquely when it deigns to penetrate into this gulf of moral and physical deformity. On this paved yard are to be seen, pacing from morning till night, pale, careworn, and haggard, like so many shadows, the men whom justice holds beneath the steel she is sharpening. There, crouched against the side of the wall which attracts and retains the most heat, they may be seen sometimes talking to one another, but more frequently alone, watching the door which sometimes opens to call forth one from the gloomy assemblage, or to throw in another outcast from society. The court of St. Bernard has its own particular parlour. It is a long square divided by two upright gratings, placed at a distance of 3 feet from one another, to prevent a visitor from shaking hands with or passing anything to the prisoners. It is a wretched, damp, nay, even horrible spot, more especially when we consider the fearful conferences which have taken place between those iron bars. And yet, frightful though this spot may be, it is considered as a kind of paradise to the men whose days are numbered. It is so rare for them to leave the lion's den for any other place than the Barrière Saint-Jacques or the galleys. In the court which we have attempted to describe, and from which a damp vapour was rising, a young man might be seen walking with his hands in his pockets, who had excited much curiosity amongst the inhabitants of the den. The cut of his clothes would have made him pass for an elegant man if those clothes had not been torn to ribbons. Still, they were not worn, and the fine cloth soon recovered its gloss in the parts which were still perfect beneath the careful hands of the prisoner, who tried to make it assume the appearance of a new coat. He bestowed the same attention upon the cambric front of a shirt, which had considerably changed in colour since his entrance into the prison, and he polished his varnished boots with the corner of a handkerchief embroidered with initials surmounted by a coronet. Some of the inmates of the lion's den were watching the operations of the prisoner's toilet with considerable interest.
"See, the prince is beautifying himself," said one of the thieves. "He is naturally very handsome," said another, "and if he had only a comb and some pomatum, he would soon eclipse all the gentlemen in white kids. His coat looks nearly new, and his boots are brilliant. It is pleasant to have such well-dressed brethren. But didn't those gendarmes behave shamefully? What jealousy to tear such clothes!"
"He appears to be someone of consequence," said another. "He dresses in first-rate style. And then, to be here so young! Oh, it is splendid!"
Meanwhile, the object of this hideous admiration approached the wicket against which one of the keepers was leaning.
"Come, sir," he said, "lend me 20 francs. You will soon be paid. You run no risks with me. Remember, I have relations who possess more millions than you have deniers. Come, I beseech you, lend me 20 francs so that I may buy a dressing gown. It is intolerable always to be in a coat and boots. And what a coat, sir, for a prince of the Cavalcanti!"
The keeper turned his back and shrugged his shoulders. He did not even laugh at what would have caused anyone else to do so. He had heard so many utter the same things. Indeed, he heard nothing else.
"Come," said Andrea, "you are a man void of compassion. I will cause you to lose your place."
This made the keeper turn round, and he burst into a loud laugh. The prisoners then approached and formed a circle.
"I tell you that with that wretched sum," continued Andrea, "I could obtain a coat and a room in which to receive the illustrious visitor I am daily expecting."
"He is right, he is right," said the prisoners. "Anyone can see he is a gentleman." "Well, then, lend him the 20 francs, said the keeper, leaning on the other shoulder. "Surely you will not refuse a comrade."
"I am no comrade of these people," said the young man proudly. "You have no right to insult me thus."
"Do you hear him?" said the keeper with a disagreeable smile. "He rates you handsomely. Come, lend him the 20 francs, eh?"
The thieves looked at one another with low murmurs, and a storm gathered over the head of the aristocratic prisoner, raised less by his own words than by the manner of the keeper. The latter, sure of quelling the tempest when the waves became too violent, allowed them to rise to a certain pitch that he might be revenged on the importunate Andrea, and besides, it would afford him some recreation during the long day. The thieves had already approached Andrea, some screaming, "La savate! La savate!" a cruel operation which consists in flogging any comrade who may have fallen into disgrace, not with an old shoe, but with an iron-heeled one. Others proposed languille, another kind of recreation, in which a handkerchief is filled with sand, pebbles, and half-pence when they have them, which the wretches discharge like a flail against the head and shoulders of the unhappy sufferer.
"Let us horsewhip the fine gentleman," said others.
But Andrea, turning towards them, winked his eyes, rolled his tongue round his cheeks, and smacked his lips in a manner equivalent to 100 words among the bandits when forced to be silent. It was a Masonic sign Caderousse had taught him. He was immediately recognized as one of them. The handkerchief was thrown down, and the iron-heeled shoe replaced on the foot of the wretch to whom it belonged. Some voices were heard to say that the gentleman was right, that he intended to be civil in his way, and that they would set the example of liberty of conscience, and the mob retired. The keeper was so stupefied at this scene that he took Andrea by the hands and began examining his person, attributing the sudden submission of the inmates of the lion's den to something more substantial than mere fascination. Andrea made no resistance, though he protested against it. Suddenly, a voice was heard at the wicket.
"Benedetto!" exclaimed an inspector.
The keeper relaxed his hold.
"I am called," said Andrea.
"To the parlour," said the same voice.
"You see, someone pays me a visit. Ah, my dear sir, you will see whether a Cavalcanti is to be treated like a common person."
And Andrea, gliding through the court like a black shadow, rushed out through the wicket, leaving his comrades and even the keeper lost in wonder. Certainly a call to the parlour had scarcely astonished Andrea less than themselves, for the wily youth, instead of making use of his privilege of waiting to be claimed on his entry into La Force, had maintained a rigid silence.
"Everything," he said, "proves me to be under the protection of some powerful person. This sudden fortune, the facility with which I have overcome all obstacles, an unexpected family and an illustrious name awarded to me, gold showered down upon me, and the most splendid alliances about to be entered into, an unhappy lapse of fortune and the absence of my protector have reduced me, certainly, but not for ever. The hand which has retreated for a while will be again stretched forth to save me, at the very moment when I shall think myself sinking into the abyss. Why should I risk an imprudent step? It might alienate my protector. He has 2 means of extricating me from this dilemma, the one by a mysterious escape managed through bribery, the other by buying off my judges with gold. I will say and do nothing until I am convinced that he has quite abandoned me, and then..."
Andrea had formed a plan which was tolerably clever. The unfortunate youth was intrepid in the attack and rude in the defence. He had borne with the public prison and with the privations of all sorts. Still, by degrees, nature, or rather custom, had prevailed, and he suffered from being naked, dirty, and hungry. It was at this moment of ennui that the inspector's voice called him to the visiting-room. Andrea felt his heart leap with joy. It was too soon for a visit from the juge d'instruction, and too late for one from the director of the prison or the doctor. It must, then, be the visitor he hoped for. Behind the grating of the room into which Andrea had been led, he saw, while his eyes dilated with surprise, the dark and intelligent face of Monsieur Bertuccio, who was also gazing with sad astonishment upon the iron bars, the bolted doors, and the shadow which moved behind the other grating.
"Ah," said Andrea, deeply affected.
"Good morning, Benedetto," said Bertuccio, with his deep, hollow voice.
"You... you,"
said the young man, looking fearfully around him.
"Do you not recognize me, unhappy child?"
"Silence! Be silent!" said Andrea, who knew the delicate sense of hearing possessed by the walls.
"For heaven's sake, do not speak so loud."
"You wish to speak with me alone, do you not?" said Bertuccio.
"Oh, yes, that is well."
And Bertuccio, feeling in his pocket, signed to a keeper whom he saw through the window of the wicket.
"Read," he said.
"What is that?" asked Andrea.
"An order to conduct you to a room and to leave you there to talk with me."
Oh, cried Andrea, leaping with joy. Then he mentally added, still, my unknown protector, I am not forgotten. They wish for secrecy, since we are to converse in a private room. I understand Bertuccio has been sent by my protector.
The keeper spoke for a moment with a superior, then opened the iron gates and conducted Andrea to a room on the first floor. The room was whitewashed, as is the custom in prisons, but it looked quite brilliant to a prisoner, though a stove, a bed, a chair, and a table formed the whole of its sumptuous furniture. Bertuccio sat down upon the chair. Andrea threw himself upon the bed. The keeper retired.
"Now," said the steward, "what have you to tell me?"
"And you?" said Andrea.
"You speak first."
"Oh, no. You must have much to tell me, since you have come to seek me."
"Well, be it so.
You have continued your course of villainy. You have robbed, you have assassinated."
"Good!
If you had me taken to a private room only to tell me this, you might have spared yourself the trouble. I know all these things. But there are some with which, on the contrary, I am not acquainted. Let us talk of those, if you please. Who sent you?"
"Come, come, you are going on quickly, Monsieur Benedetto."
"Yes, and to the point. Let us dispense with useless words. Who sends you?"
"No one. How did you know I was in prison?"
"I recognized you, some time since, as the insolent dandy who so gracefully mounted his horse in the Champs-Élysées."
"Oh, the Champs-Élysées. Ah, we burn, as they say at some game. The Champs-Élysées.
Come, let us talk a little about my father."
"Who, then, am I?"
"You, sir.
You are my adopted father. But it was not you, I presume, who placed at my disposal 100,000 francs, which I spent in 4 or 5 months. It was not you who manufactured an Italian gentleman for my father. It was not you who introduced me into the world and had me invited to a certain dinner at Auteuil, which I fancy I am eating at this moment in company with the most distinguished people in Paris, amongst the rest with a certain procureur du roi, whose acquaintance I did very wrong not to cultivate, for he would have been very useful to me just now. It was not you, in fact, who bailed me for 1 or 2 millions when the fatal discovery of the Pot aux Roses took place. Come, speak, my worthy Corsican, speak.
What do you wish me to say? I will help you.
You were speaking of the Champs-Élysées just now, worthy foster father.
Well?
Well, in the Champs-Élysées there resides a very rich gentleman, at whose house you robbed and murdered, did you not?
I believe I did.
The Count of Monte Cristo?
You have named him.
Well, am I to rush into his arms and strain him to my heart, crying as they do in the dramas, 'My father, my father!'"
"Do not let us jest," gravely replied Bertuccio, "and dare not to utter that name again as you have pronounced it."
"Bah," said Andrea, a little overcome by the solemnity of Bertuccio's manner.
"Why not?"
"Because the person who bears it is too highly favoured by heaven to be the father of such a wretch as you."
"Oh, these are fine words,
and there will be fine doings if you do not take care."
"Menaces?
I do not fear them. I will say, do you think you are engaged with a pygmy like yourself?" said Bertuccio, in so calm a tone and with so steadfast a look that Andrea was moved to the very soul. "Do you think you have to do with galley-slaves or novices in the world? Benedetto, you are fallen into terrible hands. They are ready to open for you. Make use of them. Do not play with the thunderbolt they have laid aside for a moment, but which they can take up again instantly if you attempt to intercept their movements."
"My father! I will know who my father is," said the obstinate youth. "I will perish if I must, but I will know it. What does scandal signify to me? What possessions, what reputation have I? You great people always lose something by scandal, notwithstanding your millions. Come, who is my father?"
"I came to tell you."
"Ah," cried Benedetto, his eyes sparkling with joy.
Just then the door opened, and the jailer, addressing himself to Bertuccio, said,
"Excuse me, sir, but the juge d'instruction is waiting for the prisoner."
"And so closes our interview," said Andrea to the worthy steward. "I wish the troublesome fellow were at the devil."
"I will return tomorrow," said Bertuccio.
"Good.
Gendarmes, I am at your service. Ah, sir, do leave a few crowns for me at the gate, that I may have some things I am in need of."
"It shall be done," replied Bertuccio.
109. The Judge.
We remember that the Abbe Busoni remained alone with Noirtier in the chamber of death, and that the old man and the priest were the sole guardians of the young girl's body. Perhaps it was the Christian exhortations of the Abbe, perhaps his kind charity, perhaps his persuasive words, which had restored the courage of Noirtier, for ever since he had conversed with the priest, his violent despair had yielded to a calm resignation which surprised all who knew his excessive affection for Valentine. Monsieur de Villefort had not seen his father since the morning of the death. The whole establishment had been changed. Another valet de chambre was engaged for himself, a new servant for Noirtier. Two women had entered Madame de Villefort's service. In fact, everywhere, to the concierge and coachman, new faces were presented to the different masters of the house, thus widening the division which had always existed between the members of the same family. The assizes also were about to commence, and Villefort, shut up in his room, exerted himself with feverish anxiety in drawing up the case against the murderer of Caderousse. This affair, like all those in which the Count of Monte Cristo had interfered, caused a great sensation in Paris. The proofs were certainly not convincing, since they rested upon a few words written by an escaped galley-slave on his deathbed, and who might have been actuated by hatred or revenge in accusing his companion. But the mind of the Procureur du Roi was made up. He felt assured that Benedetto was guilty, and he hoped, by his skill in conducting this aggravated case, to flatter his self-love, which was about the only vulnerable point left in his frozen heart. Once only had Villefort seen his father. It was the day after that upon which Bertuccio had paid his second visit to Benedetto, when the latter was to learn his father's name. The magistrate, harassed and fatigued, had descended to the garden of his hotel, and in a gloomy mood paced the avenue. Accidentally he turned his eyes towards the house, where he heard the sound of his son, returned from school to spend the Sunday and Monday with his mother, playing noisily. While doing so, he observed Monsieur Noirtier at one of the open windows where the old man had been placed, that he might enjoy the last rays of a sun which yet yielded some heat, and was now shining upon the dying flowers and red leaves of the creeper which twined round the balcony. The eye of the old man was riveted upon a spot which Villefort could scarcely distinguish. His glance was so full of hate, of ferocity and savage impatience, that Villefort turned out of the path he had been pursuing to see upon what person this dark look was directed. Then he saw beneath a thick clump of linden trees, which were neatly divested of foliage, Madame de Villefort sitting with a book in her hand, the perusal of which she frequently interrupted to smile upon her son, or to throw back his elastic ball, which he obstinately threw from the drawing-room into the garden. Villefort became pale. He understood the old man's meaning. Noirtier continued to look at the same object, but suddenly his glance was carried from the wife to the husband, and Villefort himself had to submit to the searching investigation of those eyes, which, while changing their object and even their language, had lost none of their menacing expression. Madame de Villefort, unconscious of all those passions that exhausted their fire over her head, at that moment held her son's ball, and was making signs to him to reclaim it with a kiss. Edouard begged for a long time, the maternal kiss probably not offering sufficient recompense for the trouble he must take to obtain it. However, at length he decided, leaped out of the window into a cluster of heliotropes and daisies, and ran to his mother, his forehead streaming with perspiration. Madame de Villefort wiped his forehead, pressed her lips upon it, and sent him back with the ball in one hand and some bonbons in the other. Villefort, drawn by an irresistible attraction like that of the bird to the serpent, walked towards the house. As he approached it, Noirtier's gaze followed him, and his eyes appeared of such a fiery brightness that Villefort felt them pierce to the very depths of his heart. In that earnest look might be read a deep reproach as well as a terrible menace. Then Noirtier raised his eyes to heaven as though to remind his son of a forgotten oath.
"It is well, sir," replied Fifor from below. "It is well. Have patience but one day longer. What I have said, I will do."
Noirtier appeared calmed by these words and turned his eyes with indifference to the other side. Fifor violently unbuttoned his greatcoat, which seemed to strangle him, and passing his livid hand across his forehead, entered his study. The next day, Monday, was the first sitting of the assizes. The morning rose bleak and gloomy, and Fifor saw the dim grey light shine upon the lines he had traced in red ink. The magistrate had slept for a short time while the lamp sent forth its final struggles. Its flickerings awoke him, and he found his fingers as damp and purple as though they had been dipped in blood. He opened the window. A bright yellow streak crossed the sky and seemed to divide in half the poplars which stood out in black relief on the horizon. In the clover fields beyond the chestnut trees, a lark was mounting up to heaven while pouring out her clear morning song. The damps of the dew bathed the head of de Vifor and refreshed his memory.
"Today," he said with an effort, "today the man who holds the knife of justice must strike wherever there is guilt."
Involuntarily his eyes wandered towards the window of Noirtier's room, whence he had seen him the preceding night. The curtain was drawn, and yet the image of his father was so vivid to his mind that he addressed the closed window as though it had been open, and as if through the opening he had beheld the menacing old man.
"Yes," he murmured, "yes, be satisfied."
His head dropped upon his breast, and in this position he paced his room. Then he threw himself, dressed as he was, upon a sofa, less to sleep than to rest his limbs, cramped with study and with the cold, which crept to the very marrow of his bones. By degrees everyone awoke. Fifor, from his room, heard the successive noises which constitute the life of a house. The opening and shutting of doors, the ringing of Madame de Vifor's bell to summon the waiting maid, mingled with the first shouts of the child, who rose full of the enjoyment of his age. Fifor also rang. His new valet de chambre brought him the papers, and with them a cup of chocolate.
"What are you bringing me?" said he.
"A cup of chocolate.
I did not ask for it. Who has paid me this attention?"
"My mistress, sir. She said you would have to speak a great deal on the case of the murder, and that you should take something to keep up your strength." And the valet placed the cup on the table nearest to the sofa, which was, like all the rest, covered with papers. The valet then left the room. Vifor looked for an instant with a gloomy expression, then, suddenly taking it up with a nervous motion, he swallowed its contents at one draught. It might have been thought that he hoped the beverage would be mortal, and that he sought for death to deliver him from a duty which he would rather die than fulfil. He then rose and paced his room with a smile it would have been terrible to witness. The chocolate was inoffensive, but Monsieur de Vifor felt no effects. The breakfast hour arrived, but Monsieur de Vifor was not at table. The valet de chambre re-entered.
"Madame de Vifor wishes to remind you, sir," he said, "that 11 o'clock has just struck, and that the trial commences at 12.
"Well," said Vifor, "what then?"
"Madame de Vifor is dressed. She is quite ready and wishes to know if she is to accompany you, sir."
"Where to?"
"To the palais."
"What to do?"
"My mistress wishes to be present at the trial."
"Ah," said Vifor with a startling accent, "does she wish that?"
The servant drew back and said, "If you wish to go alone, sir, I will go and tell my mistress."
Vifor remained silent for a moment and dented his pale cheeks with his nails.
"Tell your mistress," he at length answered, "that I wish to speak to her, and I beg she will wait for me in her own room."
"Yes, sir."
"Then come to dress and shave me."
"Directly, sir."
The valet de chambre reappeared almost instantly, and having shaved his master, assisted him to dress entirely in black. When he had finished, he said,
"My mistress said she should expect you, sir, as soon as you had finished dressing."
"I am going to her."
and Vifor, with his papers under his arm and hat in hand, directed his steps towards the apartment of his wife. At the door, he paused for a moment to wipe his damp, pale brow. He then entered the room. Madame de Vifor was sitting on an ottoman and impatiently turning over the leaves of some newspapers and pamphlets, which young Edouard, by way of amusing himself, was tearing in pieces before his mother could finish reading them. She was dressed to go out, her bonnet was placed beside her on a chair, and her gloves were on her hands. Madame de Vifor had multiplied her questions in order to gain one answer, but to all her inquiries Monsieur de Vifor remained mute and cold as a statue.
"Edouard,"